Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. Gotta be rock and roll music if you wanna dance with me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There are some things we can all agree on. The Beatles, they're great, right? And will always be great. Democracy, for all its faults, it's still great, and always will be. The universe, hey, we found the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, pretty much right where physicists said it would be. That's pretty great. But what if we're wrong? Will people in the year 3016 look back at us the way we look at people of 1016? That's the question at the heart of Chuck Klosterman's new book called But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. Chuck, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as you've done in the past, you know, you tackle a big topic in this book, but music turns out to be a kind of a key lens through which to view these questions. Well, why is that?
Well, I mean, I suppose the honest answer is that I have an especially high interest in music, and it was one of the first sections I wrote. But it is also something that I think can be used as a way to sort of understand how long-term history unspools and sort of the nature of collective memory when it comes to understanding music that doesn't really exist at the center of the culture anymore. When, you know, once music comes into existence, any genre, it doesn't matter what it is, there will always be someone, you know, executing it and creating it. It doesn't disappear, for the most part, in totality. But sometimes it moves off to the fringes and becomes almost this negligible thing, which means it becomes kind of an academic interest.
Mm-hmm.
So in this book, I sort of speculate the possibility of rock music totally receding from the culture, which to a degree already seems to be happening, but let's say it really recedes, and then in 300 years or whenever, it's just something that's taught in a college classroom as an idea that sort of defined the last half of the 20th century, and I sort of imagine how that conversation might play out.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things about that is, you know, you sort of imagine this college professor, you know, teaching this course on this old historic style of music. Would rock to this college professor and his or her students, would rock include disco and hip hop? Because as the music recedes, things that seem like very clearly defined boundaries to us might not seem that way in the future.
Well, you know, that's just kind of a question about time. I mean, right now we have, if we have a college that has a class on rock, it probably starts in the 50s and moves up to the present tense.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
If you had a more specified class, maybe it would only deal with the music of the 60s and 70s. It would really isolate that. But the farther you get down the continuum, the larger that lens gets. It could be that rock music, of course, is tied in with, you know, dance music like disco and hip-hop and all these things. There could be a point in a far enough away future where the entire 20th century is kind of tied together.
Yeah.
So Sinatra is part of the rock era. You know, pop music sort of becomes the entire umbrella. Country music might be in there because of its foundations in sort of its relationship to rock. You know, is it possible that rock and jazz could one day be intertwined if we're, say, 500 years away from this?
Mm. Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's it's kind of a mind-boggling thing to contemplate. And in your last book, I Wear the Black Hat, when we talked about that book, your study of villains, real and imagined, you had a really interesting musical example there where in just a couple of decades, the role of the quote-unquote villain in the Rolling Stones shifted from Keith to Mick.
What, yes.
And in a funny way, that little moment in your last book kind of foreshadows everything in this book, this idea that time changes things that we thought were immutable.
Well, that specific example is kind of a key part of this. It's the changing definition of what is viewed as transgressive.
Mm-hmm.
Using the Rolling Stones as an example, you know, in the 60s and early 70s, the idea of transgressive as it applied to the Stones was Keith Richards' behavior, his relationship to drugs, you know, his he's getting arrested all the time, you know, in different continents, supposedly having his blood changed, which really didn't happen. But, you know, it was like, it's sort of like the superficial description of what a transgressive individual is. But it has changed now. Now, somehow, the fact that Mick Jagger seems to look at the Rolling Stones more of a business than Keith does, and almost sort of sees it as just a way to sort of extend some kind of false commercial ideal, and maybe the rebelliousness of the Stones was just sort of what they saw as the best business plan, that is seen as more problematic and transgressive. We had made an earlier reference to disco music. Well, you know, in the late 70s, when people compared disco and punk, punk seemed like the much more transgressive idiom. You would see the Sex Pistols go on a television show in Britain, you know, and swear at the host and their appearance and their language. That seemed like they were like the most sort of subversive thing that could exist. But now, at this point, we view disco as more transgressive because disco is pushing, you know, kind of a black urban gay culture into the suburbs, and that is now perceived as a much more meaningful transgression. So now it almost seems like a disco artist was actually doing something far more subversive than the Clash or the Sex Pistols or the Ramones.
I mean, and a lot of this kind of thought is in the chapter in the book devoted to music, but you come back to music all throughout the book. You know, there's a reference to Chinese democracy that is unexplained, and if you're not a Guns N' Roses fan, you're not going to get it. There's a reference to the album Jerusalem by Sleep. I don't remember what context that's in off the top of my head.
Well, there's really only one context for that album.
The album was originally called Dope Smoker, wasn't it?
Yes.
But near the end of the book, you know, you sort of wonder, what if it's not the Beatles that get remembered from this era? What if it's the Butthole Surfers? You know, we can't control who people sort of lionize hundreds of years from now. And the idea, and this is something you cover in your chapter on writers as well, the idea that someone that many people don't yet know could end up sort of bearing the standard for our age is a really intriguing idea.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, okay, the Butthole Surfers reference, that's kind of an extreme joke. It's like, You know, if not the Beatles, it's the Butthole Surfers. I kind of maybe selected them because both bands start with the letter B.
Yeah.
But the larger point is this. It's that in a rational world, if only one rock artist were to be remembered, in a logical, rational universe, the answer is, of course, the Beatles. The Beatles sort of represent and create almost every meaningful idea we have about rock music. Any band that exists now is either consciously or unconsciously using the template that the Beatles created. However, the world is not rational. And just because in the present tense we can see something and kind of create the argument of how things should sort of domino forward, it's not probably going to be that way. That's not really how history works. So then you start thinking of alternative ways history could work out. Now, in what sort of trajectory do the Butthole Surfers become the definition of rock? That's a pretty tough one. But, you know, I was doing a book reading last night in Boston, and somebody in the audience had a bunch of questions about Trautmann's Replica, the Captain Beefheart record. Mm-hmm. And we sort of got into this discussion about the idea of how could Trautmann's Replica become sort of the freestanding identity of rock music in the future. Well, what would have to happen is the meaning of rock to people who have not yet been born, to future historians, people who will look back on this time, it would have to be that they would conclude that the most important thing about rock music was experimentation and the existence of a fringe culture and intellectual subversion of the norm. Now, if those things became the defining characteristics of rock, Trautmann's Replica suddenly becomes a real viable album to think about as, like, what represents this music. However, I think anybody who's alive right now would agree that would be a very bizarre designation of rock, and that those qualities really aren't the center of rock culture in the real world.
Hit the ground like a rooster, pivoted like a duck, her stockings down, caught dust and dough balls. She cracked her mouth, glazed, caught one eyelash, rubbed her hands on her gorgeous gingham, her hands brass, sticky metal, intricate latchwork, open to the room. A smell cold mixed with bologna. Rubber bands, crumpled wax paper bonnets, fat goose legs, and special jellies. Ignited by the warmth of the room.
But, you know, we are often, you know, we think we're right about the past, but that's just kind of our projection of our culture onto a distant time.
Chuck, they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but your cover actually has, I don't know how, if you were at all involved in this, but the cover that doesn't sit right on the book, that makes it look like you're reading the book upside down and backwards.
Well, okay.
That was brilliant.
The cover is upside down, okay? And I will say, here's a little story behind this. You know, when you write a book, I'm only concerned with the pages and the words. So there's a point where the book is maybe 6 months away from existing, and a designer comes in and gives you 5 or 6 examples of potential covers.
Right.
Maybe they take ideas you have, but they're showing you what the cover might be. And the last cover they showed us was a completely upside-down cover where every word was inverted. Now, some people in the room, I think my editor was like, that's brilliant. I think my agent was like, I don't know about this, but it's really my decision. So they ask me, and my response is, well, what's the commercial track record of upside-down books? Like, I'm not so concerned what the exterior looks like, to be honest. That's something that's unrelated to my work. But I was like, so what's the history of this? And we could not find one other example of this.
Yeah.
We found books where the image was inverted, or maybe the title was inverted, but nothing where the whole thing was upside down. So then I was like, we have to do it now. I mean, if it's never been done, if nobody has done this, we must do it.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you know, it's kind of unsettling at first because you're like, oh, let me take this off. It's upside down. And then you put it back on, and there's no right way to put it on. So, you know, it kind of... There's an analogy to be made to the way that we kind of feel about things that we quote-unquote know, you know, as a people in this time. And it seems like it's getting to something sort of essential about the book.
Maybe. I mean, I love the fact that you think that. I hope a lot of people think that. I just thought it was kind of an interesting thing to do.
Okay.
And the fact of the matter is the print is big. You know, it's just black print on a white background. I think it's still legible upside down. You know, it's not like it's written in cursive. I suppose, and also, I guess if the book fails, you know, I suppose I can always somehow claim, well, you know, we did print it upside down. So it was like, you know, that was the real issue. It wasn't the content.
All right. There is a moment where you do tackle this question head on of who will be remembered from the rock era? Who will be the emblem of the late 20th century in the Western world? And, you know, not surprisingly, it comes down to Elvis and Dylan. And what is the defining, you know, what is the differentiating mark between those two? What is it that separates the two different possible paths?
Well, after I sort of assert that the rational answer is the Beatles, but I'm accepting that rationality probably won't dictate this, I move to the next step, which is the kind of the Joseph Campbell idea of the monomyth, the idea that every story is the same story and that most of history is understood typically in Western culture through the story of one person.
Mm-hmm.
So who is the likely candidate for this? Well, these are the two candidates, Elvis and Dylan, okay? And if it worked out that the memory of rock music in some distant culture was those two individuals, it would somehow seem fair, even though, you know, neither one is a perfect encapsulation of what rock is. But if it ends up being only one, which is the more likely scenario, the entire vision of music shifts, okay? If it's Elvis who becomes the singular symbol for rock music. Well, then rock music is mostly a performative art, because Elvis didn't write his own songs. Mm-hmm. He interpreted them. He did it brilliantly. But the idea of authenticity and sort of creativity and a reflection of who you are through the music would not really be part of the equation. It would be more like, this is something that was just showbiz or entertainment. The fact that Elvis had sort of like a real sexuality and masculinity about him would become an identifying characteristic. The fact that his life ended in kind of a depressing way might give the entire idea of rock music sort of a depressing hue. That, like, there was just a, you know, that drugs and excess really kind of destroyed this art form. But if it's Dylan, everything is different. Then, authenticity is everything, and suddenly rock music is a much more political concept than it actually is in practice, even more political than Dylan is. It would be interlocked with the folk tradition. And, you know, Elvis was pretty much out of the game by 1973, but Dylan, even though he doesn't really, in a conventional sense, rock out, has existed for the totality of rock, okay? So he would sort of sweep over this entire period. And it might end up sort of becoming closer to our conception of punk and the meaning of punk. It's a shame the way she makes me scrub the floor. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. In either case, it's like we have an idea of a guy who would represent a genre, and both would be flawed, and yet those might be our two best sources.
Yeah. You know, it occurs to me, Chuck, that classical music fans have wrestled with these ideas for a long time because, you know, a relatively long time, let me put it that way, because, you know, we're talking about a couple of centuries, which I realize is the blink of an eye in the larger scheme of things. You know, pop music has its moment and then pop, it's gone. But these classical pieces have been around for centuries, and we've had a chance to watch, you know, the sort of the passage of time and how it affects who we hold up as like the key figures. So, you know, people think of symphonies and they automatically think of Beethoven.
Well, one of the people I interviewed for this book is Alex Ross, who's the classical music critic for The New Yorker, and he's written a book, The Rest is Noise, and he actually references this directly, that what is strange about this process is that as history marches forward and there's all these potential candidates, they tend to fall by the wayside one by one. The people we think are important, you know, in the present day or whatever day we're in, time moves forward and some disappear until one individual remains. And then that remaining individual's influence is amplified and exaggerated. The example I use in the book is John Philip Sousa, who I sort of view as the most successful American musician ever, in that marching music and John Philip Sousa as ideas are now interchangeable. But one of the things Alex Ross mentioned is that what's strange about how this has worked in classical music is that somebody like Beethoven or Mozart or Bach, once they sort of get in this position, the assumption is any of their work is brilliant and meaningful and transcendent. And he's not really saying it isn't. He's just saying that once you get in the position, once you're selected, okay, the selection process is arbitrary and capricious, but once you become selected, then it is almost as if every idea you ever had is the same as the concept itself.
So, you know, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony may define for many people what classical music is, but then, you know, there are little piano pieces he tossed off that are not, frankly, works of genius. And
well, I mean, you could argue that if he's a genius, all his work is a work of genius. But the difference is that, you know, you mentioned, you know, his fifth or whatever. To the average consumer, they don't even need to know the number. Yeah. They don't need to know anything about it. They don't need to have a context for it. It was just the man who made it. In this book, you know, we talk about, you know, Dylan and Elvis and that, but I also kind of forward the idea that possibly what it might be with rock is in the future, rock music is remembered as like a collection of tropes. like not so much any individual as much as certain qualities that we associate with the music. And then they'll apply those qualities to the person who almost fits this imaginary suit. And the person who fits that suit best, in all probability, at least in my mind, is Chuck Berry. You know, I mean, right. Chuck Berry is, you know, he made simple, rhythmic, primitive music, which is rock, okay? You know, rock music is simple and primitive and rhythmic. You know, he comes from the South, or at least close to the South. He's from St. Louis. You know, he was a black artist mainstreamed by white people. That's kind of the story of rock. You know, he was a very sexual person. You know, rock is an outlaw culture, and he was arrested these times. It might be that Chuck Berry sort of comes to symbolize the many ideas we have about rock, and we pour them all into him.
People singing the blues. I roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news.
You know, the other thing, though, is, you know, as we look back at music history, a lot of it has gone the way it has because we didn't have records. I mean, we literally didn't have recordings of that music. And so time marched on. And as you say, one by one, lots of names fell away and only one was left standing. But in the rock era, we have everything recorded. And I know you tackle this in the part of your book called But What If We're Right? You know, what if having all of this music documented changes the process by which, you know, those names disappear with the passage of time?
Well, I mean, it absolutely does. I mean, when we say things are lost to history, and if we're talking about, say, the 1500s, things are literally lost to history.
Yeah.
Like, they are lost. We can't find them. We don't have them. Now, when we say things are lost to history, it means a philosophical thing has happened, or a taste thing has happened, that people have chosen to ignore something and sort of let it drift away. You know, there is pretty much most, not all, but most music from the rock era does exist in some physical or digital form. So it will really now be more of a curation thing, where things that are lost will be lost because we choose to lose them. Although one thing that this isn't in the book, but I know like Steve Albini has talked about this, that he sort of fears that there's going to be a lot of digital music that we think will last forever that will actually disappear, or, you know, music on compact disc or whatever. And it's really the music that is on vinyl or tape that will survive, and that we actually will lose a bunch of music from the 80s and 90s. I don't know if this is necessarily true, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, no, I even here at WNYC, our own archives department, you know, have been very worried about things like CDs and DATs, you know, digital audio tapes from the 90s.
I mean, everybody remembers when CDs were new. One of the selling points was they'll last forever.
Yeah.
And anybody who bought a CD in the 80s knows that there's a high likelihood they don't work anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you have anywhere to play them, I guess you got to find somewhere to play them and then find out they don't work. You know?
But, you know, the idea that maybe things have changed. I mean, you know, this is not the time or the place to get into all the different scientific theories that you talk about in the book, but, you know, the idea that that something has changed, that history is a one big J curve, and, you know, it's always a J curve. It's kind of a fractal thing. You're always on that incredible upswing after a long period of flatness, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the other thing is in the abstract, everyone realizes that ideas we have now will probably change over time. If you say to somebody like, well, you know, the way we view the world now will be different in 200 years, they go, of course, that's no brilliant insight. But as soon as you start giving them specific examples, they bristle.
Right.
Because what happens is they just can't see a world where, you know, the Beatles or Dylan or something doesn't matter, or is seen as, even weirder still, less than, you know, some random thing, the band Bread or something, like could someday be seen as more meaningful than the Beatles. It's just impossible, because the thing that we can never really get our mind around is not that, you know, that the world changes, but it's that the way people perceive the world evolves as well. And the way we look at music now is not the way we're going to look at music in 150 years.
Yeah.
And when you start changing what you consider a classification like important, significant, meaningful, influential, when those terms as definitions start to change, then everything else is different.
Chuck, have you read Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy?
You know, I did, but I was, well, I shouldn't say I was a little guy, but I think I was in seventh grade.
Well,
it's interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, the idea that, you know, it's based on, there's this character, I think his name is Harry Seldon. I read it a long time ago, too. But your book reminded me of it, this idea
well,
that...
Well, I like that. That's a big compliment.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the central idea that you can't possibly predict specific things about the future, but you can look, if you pull back far enough, you can look at the broad sweep of how history, how humanity tends to move, and you can make, you know, this was the theory in Asimov's writing, that you could make some sort of guess, an educated guess that was pretty close to reality if you looked far enough in the future and just, you know, kind of pulled back far enough, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's sort of what I'm doing. I mean, I guess the principal idea of this book was I would look at how we consider history and what criteria do we use. And then I would look at the present tense and I would think, what's the criteria we use for value or import or interest? And those things weren't the same. Like, we look at history differently than we look at the contemporary world. So I just tried to think about the contemporary world using the ideas we use typically for the past.
Yeah. Yeah. And so 1,000 years from now, if one name pops up in that that distant rock history class, do you think it'll be Chuck Berry, or do you, in your gut, have a different answer?
Well, I mean, to me, because, you know, I live in this world, it seems like the answer should be the Beatles. That's the whole thing with this book. You know, I think that there's some people who suspect that this is a book of predictions, and what I'm saying is, you know, we might be wrong about this, but I'm right. That's not how it is. I mean, I'm in the same system. To me, it seems as though the Beatles are the obvious answer, and yet time and time again, the obvious answer throughout history has not emerged as what lasts. So Chuck Berry does, to me, fulfill a lot of the ways that we look at history, that there's qualities that we think are important, and we look to apply those qualities to somebody who sort of can accept them. And, you know, in that sense, and the fact that, like, even in our contemporary world, like, we consider Chuck Berry to be important. It's not like he's some sort of, you know, minor figure.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, to a particular, to say, like, you know, the older critics, like, you know, Christgau and Greil Marcus and stuff, they really view Chuck Berry as sort of central to everything. So it's not really an outlandish prediction. It's just not the obvious prediction.
Right. Well, that and many other ideas, obvious but usually not, are in Chuck Klosterman's latest book. It's brand new. It's called But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. And while we've focused on music, it's also, there are chapters on writers and gravity and democracy and all these other big ideas. And thanks for spending some time with us on Soundcheck today.
Oh, my pleasure.
He could play